Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is The Old Army Game by George Garrett. Everybody has got a story about the bad sergeant in basic. Sit down some evening with your buddies, and you'll find that's one subject everybody can deal out like a hand of cards. And that's not a bad image for it, because those stories, told or written, or even finally mounted in memory, acquire a bright, conventional, two-dimensional character. All the people in them are face cards, which seems to me as good a way as any to introduce Sergeant First Class Elwood Quince. Lean and hard-faced, a face all angles like a one-eyed jack. Perfectly turned out, everything tailored, skin-tight, glossy, spit-shined, and glowing. Field cap, white from wear and care, two fingers over the nose. Casts a flat gray semicircular shadow that way. Calls attention to the mouth, the thin, tight lips. Open, you'd expect to see even rows of fine white teeth. Instead, you'd see them yellow and no good and all awry and gaping like a worn-out picket fence. And when he did smile, it was all phony, like a jackass chewing briars. Back to the field cap. Calls attention to the mouth and hides the eyes in shadow like a mask. The eyes, with the cap off and resting on a desk, and his large, restless hands patting his straw-blonde hair, long and rich on top, but sidewalled so that with a cap or a helmet on, he looks as shaved clean as a chicken ready for the oven. The eyes are peculiarly light and cloudy at the same time, like a clear spring that somebody has spit in or stirred the mud in the bottom of with a stick. Can you see him yet? But he's still. Let's breathe on him and let him walk, because Quince's walk is important. He has two of them. A, the official walk when he's marching troops, in formation, etc., and B, when he's relaxed and just walking about the area. The former is conventional, ramrod, but natural, well-trained soldier. The latter is quite special. Light-footed, easy, insinuative, cat and woman-like. Creepy. He seemed like a ghost to us. You always look over your shoulder before you speak, because the chances are he's right there behind you and everywhere at once. Talk? Oh my, yes, he can talk. Arkansas mountain accent. Part southern and part western, and a little bit nasal and whiny and hard on the R's. Picturesque. Rural similes abound. Some extended to the epic proportion. For example, to Sax, our fat boy from New York. Sax, when I see you dragging your lard ass around the battery area, you put me in mind of an old wore-out sow in a hog pen with a measly little scrawny litter of piglets sniffing and chasing around behind her, and that old sow is just so tired and fat and goddamn lazy she can't even roll over and let 'em suck. Also frequently scatological. Here is a dialogue, Sergeant Quince and me. In open ranks. Inspection. He's right in front of me. I'm looking straight into the shadow of his cap casts. Quince. Do you know how low you are? Me, learning to play by ear. Pretty low, Sergeant. Quince. Pretty low? No, I mean, just how low? Me. I don't know, Sergeant. Quince. Well then, since you're so ignorant, I'll tell you. You're lower than whale shit, and you know where that is, don't you? Me. Yes, Sergeant. Quince. On the bottom of the ocean. Quince passes on to the next victim. The tone of voice? Always soft. Never raises his voice except in giving commands. Otherwise speaks just above a whisper. You have to strain to hear him. When we arrived at Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, the Army's mansion pitched in the seat of excrement now that Camp Polk, Louisiana, and Camp Blanding, Florida are closed up tight as a drum, left to hobos, rats, bugs, weeds, etc., we were assigned to take basic training in Sergeant Quince's outfit. I call it his outfit, because the battery commander had a hair lip and was as shy as a unicorn, stayed in his office all day. The first sergeant had V-shaped wound stripes from the First World War, I swear, and didn't care about anything but getting out a morning report without erasures and also the little flower garden he had all around the orderly room shack that he tended and watered with a cute watering can just like little Bo Peep's. Nevertheless, Sergeant Cobb started out as a presence, austere and lonely and unapproachable, but thought of as an ultimate tribunal where possibly wrongs might be righted, a kind of tired old god we might turn to one day in despair of salvation from Quince, come to him as broken children, and he'd sigh and forgive us. Until there came a test one day. Sergeant Quince marched the whole battery, 160-odd men and 4 heavy-booted platoons, right across one side of Cobb's garden. By the time the first platoon had passed by, Cobb was out of the office, hatless, necktie askew, and loose like a long tongue, eyes burning. Aha, thought we of Sergeant Quince, the original young man so spick and span, something unpleasant will hit the fan now. But it didn't. Cobb stood there, looking and wilted. Tears brimmed in his eyes and spilled down his cheeks. He watched his tended stalks and blossoms go down under the irresistible marching feet of progress, of mutability, of change and decay. And he never said a word. He slumped and shook his fist, a helpless old man. Meanwhile, Quince ignored him, counted a crisp cadence for the marching troops, and grinned just like a jackass chewing briars. And our hearts sank like stones to see the mighty fallen. So, though he was merely the field first, it was Quince's outfit to make or break. His little brotherhood of lesser cadre revolved like eager, breathless planets around his indubitable magnificence. From our first formation, we in rumpled new ill-fitting fatigues and rough new boots, he sartorial with, glinting in the sun, the polished brass of the whistle he loved so well. "Gentlemen," he said, "you all are about to begin the life of a soldier. My name is Sergeant Quince. Your name is Shit. War going on in Korea, etc. We would learn how to soldier and not get our private parts shot off by the gooks, whether we liked it or not. We would rue the day, his word, we ever saw his face or this godforsaken battery area. We would learn to hate him. We wouldn't have dreamed we were able to hate anybody as much as we were going to hate him, etc., etc., etc." "Let's be clear about one thing," he said, looking down from the barrack step into our upraised, motley melting pot faces. "I hate niggers. They're black bastards to me, but I'll just call them niggers for short around here during duty hours." A negro standing next to me winced as if he'd been kicked in the stomach. "If anybody don't like it, let him go and see the IG. I also hate Jews, wops, spicks, micks, cotton pickers, Georgia crackers, Catholics, and Protestants. I hate all of you, damn your eyes." I really believe he meant it. At this point, according to the conventions of the tale of the bad sergeant, written or told, the story usually takes a turn, a peripeteia of a modest sort. You're supposed to be given a hint of his problems before moving on. Let's do it. I have no objection, but I reserve the right to call it giving the devil his due. We were a crazy mixed-up bunch, farm boys, black and white, from the deep south, street boys from the jungle of fists in the big cities, college boys. Accidents. A 35-year-old lawyer who got drafted by mistake. A cripple who was used for some weeks to fire up the boilers and keep the boiler rooms clean before his medical discharge finally came through. 2 fat, sullen American Indians. Mexican wetbacks. I remember one of these had a fine handlebar mustache. Quince walked up to him and plucked it. "Only 2 kinds of people can wear a mustache and get away with it," he said. "Movie stars and queers." He used another more vividly descriptive term, but I've never seen that particular one in print except in the Henry Miller books that you have to smuggle in, and since I'm not standing on innovation, I'll let it pass. "I don't recall you seeing your ugly face in the picture show. Shave it off." So there we were. I'll give Quince this much credit. He wasn't the least bit interested in molding us into a fighting team. He wasn't crazy that way. His reach didn't exceed his grasp that much. He was merely involved in getting us through a cycle of basic training. We hated each other, fought each other singly and in groups in the barracks and the privacy of the boiler rooms, with that poor cripple who was responsible for the care and maintenance thereof cowering in a corner behind the boiler, but armed with a poker lest he too become involved. We stole from each other, ratted on each other, goofed off on each other. Soldiering on the job, this is sometimes called in real life with good reason. And thus made every bit of work about twice as hard and twice as long as it had to be. And if anything, the situation pleased Quince. He perched on his mobile, on roller skates, Olympus, and chewed briars while we played root-hog and grab-ass in the dust and mud below. Strict? My lord, yes, I would say so. No passes at all during the whole cycle. GA parties every night until our fatigues fell to shreds from splashed Clorox and the rough wood floors were as smooth and white as a stone by the shore. Polished the nail heads nightly, too, with matchsticks wrapped in cotton, dipped in brasso. Long night hikes with full field pack. GI haircuts, march to the so-called barber once a week. Bald as convicts we were. Police call was always an agony of duck-waddling assholes and elbows on our hands and knees like penitents. How he loved police call. How he loved mail call. Gave out all the letters himself. That is, threw them into the packed, hopeful faces and let them fight and scramble for them in the dark. Opened mail and packages when he pleased. Withheld mail for days at a time as a whim. Didn't make soldiers out of us, but tractable brutes. Brutalized, cowed, we marched to and fro like the zombies in mental hospitals that they haven't got time to bother with. So they pump them full of great jolts of tranquilizers. And when we passed by, eyes front, in step, he was complimented by any high-ranking officers that witnessed. Let me say this for Quince. I know another sergeant who tried exactly the same thing and failed. He was of the same mold as Quince, but somehow subtly defective. In the end, he had to fall his troops out of the barracks with a drawn 45. Not Quince. His lips touched to the brass whistle even before he breathed into it was quite enough to make us shiver. A sadist, too, individually. Poor white, soft, round, hairy, Jewish sack suffered indignities he couldn't have dreamed of in his worst nightmares. Once or twice was nearly drowned in a dirty toilet bowl. Sacks, with the other fat and soft boys, Quince's fat man squad, had regularly to participate in weenie races. What's a weenie race? I think Quince invented it. The fat boys kneel down at the starting line, pants and drawers down. Quince produces a package of Frankfurters wrapped in cellophane. One each Frankfurter is firmly inserted into each rectum. All in place? Everybody ready? Quince blows the whistle and away they crawl, sometimes 100 yards going and coming. Last man back has to eat all the Frankfurters on the spot. Tears and pleading move Quince not a whit. Not puking or anything else. One time, Quince lost his head about one barracks which had some way failed to live up to his expectations. He and his attendant cadre went raging through that barracks, tearing up beds, knocking over wall lockers, and destroying everything personal they could get their hands on. Cameras, portable radios, fountain pens, books, letters, photographs, etc. How did these various things happen? You're bound to ask. Didn't anybody go to the inspector general, the chaplain, write a congressman or mother? Not to my knowledge. Anyone could have, it's true, but all were very young and in mortal fear of the man. Who would be the first to go? No one went. And mirabilis, nobody cracked up. If anything, we got tougher and tougher every day, gave our souls to God. Or maybe, entirely justified in your contempt, don't give me no sad tales of woe, you'll just say. So what? What do you want me to do? Punch your TS card? That would be to misunderstand. Agreed that in a century like ours, these things are small doings, negligible discomforts. It would be sheer sentimentality to claim otherwise. And I'm not cockeyed enough to think that such events could arouse your pity and terror. Nothing of great men falling from high place in our time. A battle in the anthill, maybe. No, the simple facts arranged and related, my hand of cards, will never do that. But they are nevertheless not insignificant. Why, you say? Why bother? Excuse me, but Maxim Gorky said it once and better than I can, so I quote. Why do I relate these abominations? So that you may know, kind sirs, that all is not past and done with. You have a liking for grim fantasies. You are delighted by horrible stories well told. The grotesquely terrible excites you pleasantly. But I know of genuine horrors, everyday terrors, and I have the undeniable right to excite you unpleasantly by telling you about them, in order that you may remember how we live and under what circumstances. A low and unclean life it is, ours, and that is the truth. I am a lover of humanity, and I have no desire to make anyone miserable, but one must not be sentimental, nor hide the grim truth with the motley words of beautiful lies. Let us face life as it is. All that is good and human in our hearts needs renewing. Thus we survived, endured, lived through it, and the cycle came to an end, a screeching halt. Last day on the range, rocket launchers, we fired $25,000 worth of ammunition into the side of a hill as fast as we could, so that the range officer could get back to camp early. If he didn't use the ammo all up, he'd be issued proportionally less for the following day. We were glad to assist him in his dilemma. We fired it away with joy and abandon. What explosions! What flashes of flame and clouds of smoke! It's a wonder we didn't kill each other. That night we sat in the barracks packing our duffel bags. A fine cold rain was falling outside, and we were quiet inside, lonesome survivors, because somehow you never quite imagined anything like that coming to an end. It was a calm, respectable barracks room scene. You could have photographed it and mailed the picture home. Up the steps, weary-footed, his cap soaking wet and his raincoat beaded with raindrops and dripping, came the old first sergeant, Cobb. He asked us to gather around, and he talked to us quietly. There had been a personal tragedy in the family of Sergeant Quince. That bastard had a family? His wife had been in a terrible automobile accident and was dying. A wife yet? He wanted to go home before she died. He had to arrange for somebody to look after the children. Children? The trouble was that this time of the month, Sergeant Quince didn't have any money, even for train fare one way. He was broke. Why don't he go to the Red Cross, somebody said. Sergeant Cobbs shrugged. He ain't got time, I guess, he said. I know he ain't a kind-hearted man, boys. And you don't have to do this. It's strictly voluntary. But give a little something. He's human, and he needs your help. Give from your heart. He took a helmet liner off the top of somebody's wall locker and held it in his hand like a collection plate in church. Somebody hawked and spat on the floor. I didn't think anybody would give anything. We just stood there and stared at Sergeant Cobb until Sachs pushed through to the front. Here's my contribution, he said, and he dropped a dime into the helmet liner. Everybody started to laugh, and even the thick-headed ones caught on. Each of us put a dime in the pot. 10 cents for Sergeant Quince in his hour of need. Sergeant Cobb emptied the liner, put the dimes in his raincoat pocket, placed the liner back on top of the wall locker, and started to leave. At the front door, he turned around, shook his head, and giggled. Don't that beat all, he said. They done exactly the same thing in all the other barracks, too. Half an hour later, we had the exquisite pleasure of looking out of the windows and seeing Sergeant Quince in his Class A uniform with his double row of World War II ribbons stand in the rain in the middle of the battery area and get soaking wet. He cussed and cussed us and threw those dimes high, wide, and handsome in a way. He wished us all damnation, death, and hell. This is where it ought to end. It would be a swell place to end with the picture of Quince Furioso, throwing fountains of dimes in the air. Enraged and possessed and frustrated, like that man wildly digging for non-existent gold at the end of William Faulkner's The Hamlet. Yes, Quince in insane rage, hurling our proffered dimes in the air, wild and black-faced with frustration and tribulation, would be a fine fade-out in the modern manner. But not so. Not so soon did he fade out of my life. Nor, I guess, did I expect him to. Sachs and I went to leadership school. What happened to the rest of them, I wouldn't know and couldn't care less. But Sachs and myself took our duffel bags and waited in front of the orderly room. The hair-lipped captain came out and painfully wished us well. We climbed over the tailgate of a deuce and a half and rode to the other side of camp where they try and make you into an NCO in 3 months flat or turn you into jelly. Why are you going? Sachs asked me. As if I understood at the outset why he was doing it. I had hardly spoken to Sachs before that. Because that son of a bitch Quince is trash, I said. I don't like to be pushed around by trash. Sachs grinned. You Southerners, he said. You Southerners and your pride and your squabbles. I won't bore you with the sordid details of that place except to say that they made us and we made it. It worked. Sachs shed 30 pounds, went at every bit of it with fury and determination, and emerged the top man in the class. Believe it or not. Many a husky specimen fell among the thorns and withered out of school, but Sachs thrived, grew, bloomed. I was in the top 10 myself, and both of us made sergeant out of it. We soldiered night and day like madmen. We learned all the tricks of the trade. When we were finished, we were sharp, bandbox soldiers. The metamorphosis was complete. Still, it's only fair to point out that we kept laughing about it. Sachs called it being in disguise and referred to his uniform as a costume. He called us both the masqueraders. I called myself the invisible white man. One anecdote only of that time I'll insert. The anecdote of the word. It helps to explain the game we were playing. One week early in the course, I was doing badly and it looked like I would wash out. I'd get good marks and only a few gigs one day, poor marks and many the next. The TAC/NCO wrote on my weekly report that he thought I was a good man, but that I had been vacillating. He was a college boy himself and used that word. Well, shortly thereafter, the company commander called us both into his inner sanctum. We got shaped up in a big hurry and reported. His office was a room as bare as a monk's cell, except for one huge sign on the wall that read, "This too shall pass." He, the captain, was a huge hulk of a man, a former All-American tackle from someplace or other, a bull neck, a bulging chest behind the desk, and all jaw, lantern, and or granite with the Mussolini thrust to it. He was dead serious. We were quivering arrows at attention in front of him. "I have this here report before me," he said. "You say here that this soldier has been vacillating. What do you mean?" The TAC gulped and patiently tried to explain what he had meant by means of the image of the pendulum of a grandfather's clock swinging back and forth. The captain heard him out, nodded. "Clerk!" he roared. The company clerk came tearing into the room like somebody trying to steal second, saluted, quivered too. "Get me a dictionary." We waited in breathless anticipation. The clerk soon returned with the dictionary. Captain opened it to the V's and followed his index finger, thick and blunt-headed as a chisel, down the line of words. Looked at the word a while and the definition. It was a pocket dictionary and defined as follows. Vacillate. V-I, lated, lating. 1. Waver, stagger. 2. Fluctuate. 3. Be irresolute or hesitant. Nothing about pendulums, he noted. Damn good word, though. Good word. He wrote it down on a pad in capitals and underlined it several times. That was that. We were dismissed. Now from that orderly room issued forth each week reams of mimeograph material for the benefit of all students. Ever after that incident, the captain cautioned that those who wished to complete the course successfully must not vacillate. This got to be a standing joke in that mirthless place. "If I catch any of you guys vacillating in the company area," the TAC used to tell us, "you've had it." Sachs and I made it, were transformed from anarchists to impeccable sergeanthood. We didn't end up going to Korea to be shot at, but instead were sent to Europe to join a very sharp outfit where we would be able to maintain the high standards we had so recently acquired, which we did for the rest of our service time. Sachs was so good he even made sergeant first class without time and grade. More than a year later, we were in Germany for maneuvers. It was the middle of summer, and we were living in tents. In the evenings, we used to go to a huge circus tent of a beer hall and get drunk. It was there one hot night that we met Quince again. He was sitting all alone at a table with a big crowd of empty 3-2 beer cans around him. He was a corporal now, 2 stripes down, and by the patch on his shoulder, we knew he was in a mucked-up outfit, a whole division of stumblebums with a well-known cretin commanding. He looked it, too. His uniform was dirty. His shirt was open all the way down the front, revealing a filthy, sweat-soaked T-shirt. Of course it's hard to look sharp if you're living in the field in the middle of the summer. But Sachs and I took pride in our ability to look as sharp in the field as in garrison. It took some doing, but we could do it. "Let's buy the bastard a beer," Sachs said. He seemed glad to see us as if we were dear, old, long-lost friends. Once we had introduced ourselves, that is. He didn't recognize us at first. He marveled at our transformation and good luck. We couldn't help marveling at his transformation, too. "This is the worst outfit I was ever with," he admitted. "The battery commander has got it in for me." He bought us a round and we bought more. Late, just before they shut the place down and threw everybody out, Quince went maudlin, a crying drunk. I can't explain it, but it makes me feel bad to see you guys like this, he said. I hated you guys, I'll admit that, long before the dimes. But I didn't know you hated me so much. What do you mean by that? To hunt me down after all this time and shame me. Soldiering is my life. It's just a couple of years for you guys. And here you are with all this rank, looking like old soldiers. Sergeants! God damn, it isn't fair. Do you know what the army is, Quince? What? What's that? I'll tell you what the army is to me, Sax said. It's just a game, a stupid, brutal, pointless, simple-minded game. And you know what, Corporal Quince? I beat that game. I won. I'm a better soldier now than you ever were or ever will be, and it doesn't mean a thing to me. Quince turned his head away from us so we couldn't see him crying. You hadn't ought to have said that, he said. You can't take everything away from a guy. You got to leave a guy something. We left him to cry in his beer until they tossed him out and walked back under the stars to our tents, singing the whole way. We sat in our sleeping bags and had a smoke before we flaked out. You were great, I told Sax. That was worth waiting for. But Sax was a moody kind of a guy. He didn't see it that way. He was angry, in fact. You can't beat them down, he said, no matter what you do. They always win out in the end. Sure, I got in my licks, but he won anyway. He made me do it. That was the Quince in me kicking him while he's down. So in the end, he still beat me. You worry about yourself too much. That's just the way I am, he said bitterly. You don't feel sorry for him, do you? That was a dumb question. Sax was no Herman Wouk. Hell no, he said. You don't get it. The trouble is I still hate him. I hate him worse than ever. And he stubbed out his cigarette and turned over and went to sleep without another word, leaving me to ponder on that for a while. And that story was The Old Army Game by George Garrett, from 50 Best American Short Stories, edited by Martha Foley. The next story is from the same book. Search Through the Streets of the City by Irwin Shaw. When he finally saw her, he nearly failed to recognize her. He walked behind her for a half block, vaguely noticing that the woman in front of him had long legs and was wearing a loose, college girlish linen coat and a plain brown felt hat. Suddenly, something about the way she walked made him remember. The almost affected rigidity of her back and straightness of throat and head, with all the movement of walking flowing up to the hips and stopping there, like Negro women in the South and Mexican and Spanish women carrying baskets on their heads. For a moment he watched her walk along 12th Street on the sunny side of the street, in front of the little tired gardens behind which lay the quiet, pleasantly run-down old houses. Then he caught up with her and touched her arm. Low heels, he said. I never thought I'd live to see the day. She looked around in surprise and smiled widely and took his arm. Hello, Paul, she said. I've gone in for health. Whenever I think of you, he said, I think of the highest heels in New York City. The old days, Harriet said. They walked slowly down the sunny street toward 6th Avenue. I was a frivolous creature. You still walk the same way, as though you ought to have a basket of laundry on your head. I practice walking like that for 6 months. You'd be surprised how much attention I get walking into a room that way. I wouldn't be surprised, Paul said, looking at her. She had black hair and pale, clear skin and a long, full body, and her eyes were deep gray and always brilliant, even after she'd been drinking for 3 days in a row. Harriet began to walk a little faster. I'm going to Wanamaker, she said. There's a couple of things I have to buy. Where are you going? Wanamaker's, Paul said. I've been dying to go to Wanamaker's for 3 years. They walked in silence for a few moments, Harriet's arm in his. Casual, Paul said. I bet to the naked eye we look casual as hell. How do you feel? Harriet took her arm away. Casual? Oh, then that's how I feel, too. Paul whistled a few bars of the 1812 Overture. He stopped and looked critically at her, and she stopped too and turned toward him, a slight, puzzled smile on her face. What makes you dress that way? He asked. You look like Monday morning in Northampton. I just threw on whatever was nearest, Harriet said. I'm just going to be out about an hour. You used to look like a nice big box of candy in your clothes. Paul took her arm and they started off again. Viennese bonbons, every indentation carefully exploited in silk and satin. Even if you were just going down to the corner for a pint of gin, you'd look like something that ought to be eaten for dessert. This is no improvement. A girl has different periods in clothes, Harriet said, like Picasso, and if I'd known I was going to meet you, I'd have dressed differently. Paul patted her arm. That's better. He eyed her obliquely as they walked, the familiar long face, the well-known wide mouth, with always a little too much lipstick on it, the little teeth that made her face, when she smiled, look suddenly like a little girl's in Sunday school. You're getting skinny, Paul, Harriet said. Paul nodded. I'm as lean as a herring. I've been leading a fevered and ascetic life. What sort of life have you been leading? I got married. Harriet paused a moment. Did you hear I got married? I heard, Paul said. The last time we crossed 6th Avenue together, the L was still up. I feel a nostalgic twinge for the 6th Avenue L. They hurried as the light changed. On the night of January 9th, 1940, Paul said, holding her elbow until they crossed the street, you were not home. Possible, Harriet said. I'm a big girl now. I go out at night. I happened to pass your house and I noticed that the light wasn't on. They turned down toward 9th Street. I remember how hot you kept that apartment, like the Dahlia greenhouse in the botanical garden. I have thin blood, Harriet said gravely. Long years of inbreeding in Massachusetts. The nicest thing about you, Paul said, was you never went to sleep. Every lady to her own virtue, Harriet said. Some women are beautiful, some are smart. Me, I never went to sleep. The secret of my great popularity. Paul grinned. Shut up. Harriet smiled back at him and they chuckled together. You know what I mean, he said. Any time I called you up, 2, 3 in the morning, you'd come right over, lively and bright-eyed, all the rouge and mascara in the right places. In my youth, said Harriet, I had great powers of resistance. In the morning, we'd eat breakfast at Beethoven, the masterwork hour, WNYC, Beethoven by special permission of His Honor the Mayor, from 9 to 10. Paul closed his eyes for a moment. The little flower, Mayor for lovers. Paul opened his eyes and looked at the half-strange, half-familiar woman walking lightly at his side. He remembered lying close to her, dreamily watching the few lights of the towers of the nighttime city framed by the big window of his bedroom against the black sky, and one night when she moved sleepily against him and rubbed the back of his neck where the hair was sticking up in sharp little bristles because he had had his hair cut that afternoon. Harriet had rubbed them the wrong way, smiling dreamily without opening her eyes. What a delicious thing a man is, she'd murmured. And she'd sighed, then chuckled a little and fallen asleep, her hand still on the clipped back of his neck. Paul smiled, remembering. You're still laughing at my clothes? Harriet asked. I remembered something I heard someplace, Paul said. What a delicious thing a man is. Harriet looked at him coldly. Who said that? Paul squinted suspiciously at her. Oswald Spengler. Uh-huh, Harriet said soberly. It's a famous quotation. It's a well-turned phrase, said Paul. That's what I think, too. Harriet nodded and walked a little faster. They passed the run-down bar where they'd sat afternoons all one winter, drinking martinis and talking and laughing so loud the people at the other tables would turn and smile. Paul waited for Harriet to say something about the place, but she didn't even seem to notice it. There's Eddie's bar, Paul said. Uh-huh, Harriet nodded. He's going to start making his martinis with sherry when all the French vermouth runs out, Paul said. It sounds horrible, Harriet made a face. Is that all you have to say? Paul said loudly, remembering the times he'd looked in to see if she was there. What do you want me to say? Harriet looked honestly puzzled, but Paul had never known when she was lying to him or telling the truth anyway, and he hadn't improved in these 2 years, he discovered. I don't want you to say anything, he said. I'll take you in and buy you a drink. No, thanks. I've really got to get to Wanamaker's and back home in a hurry. Give me a rain check. Yeah, Paul said sourly. They turned into 9th Street toward 5th Avenue. I knew I'd meet you someplace finally, Paul said. I was curious to see what would happen. Harriet didn't say anything. She was looking absently at the buildings across the street. Don't you ever talk anymore? Paul asked. What did happen? Every once in a while, he began, I meet some girl I used to know. I bet the country's full of them, Harriet said. The country's full of everybody's ex-girls. Harriet nodded. I never thought of it that way, but you're right. Most of the time I think, isn't she a nice, decent person? Isn't it wonderful I'm no longer attached to her? The first girl I ever had, Paul said, is a policewoman now. She subdued a gangster single-handed in Coney Island last summer. Her mother won't let her go out of the house in her uniform. She's ashamed for the neighbors. Naturally, Harriet said. Another girl I used to know changed her name and danced in the Russian ballet. I went to see her dance the other night. She has legs like a Fordham tackle. I used to think she was beautiful. I used to think you were beautiful, too. We were a handsome couple, Harriet said, except you always needed a shave. That electric razor. I've given it up. They were passing his old house now, and he looked at the doorway and remembered all the times he and Harriet had gone in and come out. The rainy days and the early snowy mornings with the milkman's horse silent on the white street behind them. They stopped and looked at the old red house with the shabby shutters and the window on the fourth floor they had both looked out of time and time again to see what the weather was. Paul remembered the first time, on a winter's night, he and Harriet had gone through that door together. I was so damn polite, Paul said softly. Harriet smiled. You kept dropping the key and saying, Lord, Lord, under your breath while you were looking for it. I was nervous. I wanted to make sure you knew exactly how matters stood. No illusions. Good friends. Everybody understanding everybody else. Another girl coming in from Detroit in 6 weeks. No claims on me. No claims on you. Paul looked at the window on the fourth floor and smiled. What a goddamn fool. It's a nice quiet street, Harriet said, looking up at the window on the fourth floor, too. She shook her head, took Paul's arm again. I've got to get to Wanamaker's. They started off. What are you buying at Wanamaker's? Paul asked. Harriet hesitated for a moment. Nothing much. I'm looking at some baby clothes. I'm going to have a baby. They crowded over to one side to let a little woman with four dachshunds pass them in a busy tangle. Isn't it funny, me with a baby? Harriet smiled. I lie around all day and try to imagine what it's going to be like. In between, I sleep and drink beer to nourish us. I've never had such a good time in all my life. Well, said Paul, at least it'll keep your husband out of the army. Maybe. He's a raging patriot. Good. When he's at Fort Dix, I'll meet you in Washington Square Park when you take the baby out for an airing in its perambulator. I'll put on a policeman's uniform to make it proper. I'm not such a raging patriot. They'll get you anyway, won't they? Sure. I'll send you my picture in a lieutenant suit. From Bulgaria. I have a premonition. I'm going to be called on to defend a strategic point in Bulgaria. How do you feel about it? For the first time, Harriet looked squarely and searchingly at him. Paul shrugged. It's going to happen. It's all damn silly, but it isn't as silly now as it was 10 years ago. Suddenly, Harriet laughed. What's so funny? Paul demanded. My asking you how you felt about something. I never used to have a chance. You'd let me know how you felt about everything. Roosevelt, James Joyce, Jesus Christ, Gypsy Rose Lee, Matisse, yoga, liquor, sex, and architecture. I was full of opinions in those days, Paul smiled. Lust and conversation, the firm foundations of civilized relations between the sexes. He turned and looked back at the window on the fourth floor. That was a nice apartment, he said softly. Lust and conversation. Come on, Paul, Harriet said. Wanamaker's isn't going to stay open all night. You were the only girl I ever knew I could sleep in the same bed with, Paul said. That's a hell of a thing to say to a girl, Harriet laughed. Is that your notion of a compliment? Paul shrugged. It's an irrelevant fact, or a relevant fact. Is it polite to talk to a married lady this way? No. Paul walked along with her. What do you think of when you look at me, he asked. Nothing much, Harriet said. What are you lying about? Nothing much, Harriet said. Don't you ever think, what in the name of God did I ever see in him? No, Harriet began to walk faster. Should I tell you what I think of when I look at you? No. I've been looking for you for 2 years, Paul said. My name's been in the telephone book. Harriet hurried even more, wrapping her coat tightly around her. I didn't realize I was looking for you until I saw you. Please, Paul. I would walk along the street and I'd pass a bar we'd been in together and I'd go in and sit there even though I didn't want a drink, not knowing why I was sitting there. Now I know. I was waiting for you to come in. I didn't pass your house by accident. Look, Paul, Harriet pleaded. It was a long time ago, and it was fine, and it ended. I was wrong, Paul said. Do you like hearing that? I was wrong. You know, I never did get married after all. I know, Harriet said. Please shut up. I walk along Fifth Avenue, and every time I pass St. Patrick's, I half look up to see if you're passing, because I met you that day right after you'd had a tooth pulled. And it was cold, and you were walking along with the tears streaming from your eyes, and your eyes red, and that was the only time I ever met you by accident any place. Harriet smiled. That certainly sounds like a beautiful memory. 2 years, Paul said. I've gone out with a lot of girls in the last 2 years. He shrugged. They've bored me, and I've bored them. I keep looking at every woman who passes to see if it's you. All the girls I go out with bawl the hell out of me for it. I've been walking around, following girls with dark hair to see if it'll turn out to be you, and girls with a fur jacket like that old one you had, and girls that walk in that silly, beautiful way you walk. I've been searching the streets of the city for you for 2 years, and this is the first time I've admitted it even to myself. That little Spanish joint we went the first time. Every time I pass it, I remember everything. How many drinks we had, and what the band played, and what we said, and the fat Cuban who kept winking at you from the bar, and the very delicate way we landed up in my apartment. They were both walking swiftly now, Harriet holding her hand stiffly down at her sides. There is a particular wonderful way you are joined together. Paul, stop it! Harriet's voice was flat but loud. 2 years. In 2 years, the edge should be dulled off things like that. Instead, how can you make a mistake as big as that? Paul thought. How can you deliberately be as wrong as that? And no remedy. So long as you live, no remedy. He looked harshly at Harriet. Her face was set as though she weren't listening to him and was intent only on getting across the street as quickly as possible. How about you? He asked. Don't you remember? I don't remember anything, she said. And then suddenly the tears sprang up in her eyes and streamed on the tight, distorted cheeks. I don't remember a goddamn thing, she wept. I'm not going to Wanamaker's. I'm going home. Goodbye. She ran over to a cab that was parked at the corner and opened the door and sprang in. The cab spurted past Paul and he had a glimpse of Harriet sitting stiffly upright, the tears bitter and unheeded in her eyes. He watched the cab go down Fifth Avenue until it turned. Then he turned the other way and started walking, thinking, I must move away from this neighborhood. I've lived here long enough. And that story was Searched Through the Streets of the City by Irwin Shaw from 50 Best American Short Stories, edited by Martha Foley. The last story is from the same book, A Telephone Call by Dorothy Parker. Please, God, let him telephone me now. Dear God, let him call me now. I won't ask anything else of you, truly I won't. It isn't very much to ask. It would be so little to you, God, such a little, little thing. Only let him telephone now. Please, God, please, please, please. If I didn't think about it, maybe the telephone might ring. Sometimes it does that. If I could think of something else, if I could think of something else, maybe if I counted 500 by fives, it might ring by that time. I'll count slowly. I won't cheat, and if it rings when I get to 300, I won't stop. I won't answer it until I get to 500. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50. Oh, please ring, please. This is the last time I'll look at the clock. I will not look at it again. It's 7:10. He said he would telephone at 5 o'clock. I'll call you at 5, darling. I think that's where he said, darling. I'm almost sure he said it there. I know he called me darling twice, and the other time was when he said goodbye. Goodbye, darling. He was busy, and he can't say much in the office, but he called me darling twice. He couldn't have minded my calling him up. I know you shouldn't keep telephoning them. I know they don't like that. When you do that, they know you are thinking about them and wanting them, and that makes them hate you. But I hadn't talked to him in 3 days. Not in 3 days. And all I did was ask him how he was. It was just the way anybody might have called him up. He couldn't have minded that. He couldn't have thought I was bothering him. No, of course you're not, he said. And he said he'd telephone me. He didn't have to say that. I didn't ask him to. Truly, I didn't. I'm sure I didn't. I don't think he would say he'd telephone me and then just never do it. Please don't let him do that, God. Please don't. I'll call you at 5, darling. Goodbye, darling. He was busy, and he was in a hurry, and there were people around him, but he called me darling twice. That's mine. That's mine. I have that, even if I never see him again. Oh, but that's so little. That isn't enough. Nothing's enough if I never see him again. Please let me see him again, God. Please. I want him so much. I want him so much. I'll be good, God. I will try to be better. I will, if you will let me see him again. If you will let him telephone me. Oh, let him telephone me now. Ah, don't let my prayer seem too little to you, God. You sit up there so white and old with all the angels about you and the stars slipping by. And I come to you with a prayer about a telephone call. Ah, don't laugh, God. You see, you don't know how it feels. You're so safe there on your throne with the blues swirling under you. Nothing can touch you. No one can twist your heart in his hands. This is suffering, God. This is bad, bad suffering. Won't you help me? For your son's sake, help me. You said you would do whatever was asked of you in his name. Oh, God, in the name of thine only beloved Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord, let him telephone me now. I must stop this. I mustn't be this way. Look, suppose a young man says he'll call a girl up, and then something happens and he doesn't. That isn't so terrible, is it? Why, it's going on all over the world right this minute. Oh, what do I care about what's going on all over the world? Why can't that telephone ring? Why can't it? Why can't it? Couldn't you ring? Ah, please, couldn't you? You damned ugly shiny thing. It would hurt you to ring, wouldn't it? Oh, that would hurt you. Damn you, I'll pull your filthy roots out of the wall. I'll smash your smug black face in little bits. Damn you to hell. No, 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 I must stop. I must think about something else. This is what I'll do. I'll put the clock in the other room. Then I can't look at it. If I do have to look at it, then I'll have to walk into the bedroom, and that will be something to do. Maybe before I look at it again, he will call me. I'll be so sweet to him if he calls me. If he says he can't see me tonight, I'll say, why, that's all right, dear. Why, of course it's all right. It'll be the way I was when I first met him. Then maybe he'll like me again. I was always sweet at first. Oh, it's so easy to be sweet to people before you love them. I think he must still like me a little. He couldn't have called me darling twice today if he still didn't like me a little. It isn't all gone if he still likes me a little, even if it's only a little bit. You see, God, if you would just let him telephone me, I wouldn't have to ask you anything more. I would be sweet to him. I would be gay. I would be just the way I used to be, and then he would love me again. And then I would never have to ask you for anything more. Don't you see, God? So won't you please let him telephone me? Won't you please, please, please? Are you punishing me, God, because I've been bad? Are you angry with me because I did that? Oh, but God, there are so many bad people. You could not be hard only on me. And it wasn't very bad. It couldn't have been bad. We didn't hurt anybody, God. Things are only bad when they hurt people. We didn't hurt one single soul. You know that. You know it wasn't bad, don't you, God? So won't you let him telephone me now? If he doesn't telephone me, I'll know God is angry with me. I'll count 500 by fives, and if he hasn't called me by then, I will know God isn't going to help me ever again. That will be the sign. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55. It was bad. I knew it was bad. All right, God, send me to hell. You think you're frightening me with your hell, don't you? You think your hell is worse than mine. I mustn't. I mustn't do this. Suppose he's a little late calling me up. There's nothing to get hysterical about. Maybe he isn't going to call. Maybe he's coming straight up here without telephoning. He'll be cross if he sees I've been crying. They don't like you to cry. He doesn't cry. I wish to God I could make him cry. I wish I could make him cry and tread the floor and feel his heart heavy and big and festering in him. I wish I could hurt him like hell. He doesn't wish that about me. I don't think he even knows how he makes me feel. I wish he could know without my telling him. They don't like you to tell them they've made you cry. They don't like you to tell them you're unhappy because of them. If you do, they think you're possessive and exacting. And then they hate you. They hate you whenever you say anything you really think. You always have to keep playing little games. Oh, I thought we didn't have to. I thought this was so big I could say whatever I meant. I guess you can't ever. I guess there isn't ever anything big enough for that. Oh, if he would just telephone, I wouldn't tell him I'd been sad about him. They hate sad people. I would be so sweet and so gay, he couldn't help but like me. If he would only telephone. If he would only telephone. Maybe that's what he's doing. Maybe he's coming up here without calling me up. Maybe he's on his way now. Something might have happened to him. No, nothing could ever happen to him. I can't picture anything happening to him. I never picture him run over. I never see him lying still, long and dead. I wish he were dead. That's a terrible wish. That's a lovely wish. If he were dead, he would be mine. If he were dead, I would never think of now and the last few weeks. I would remember only the lovely times. It would be all beautiful. I wish he were dead. I wish he were dead, dead, dead. This is silly. It's silly to go wishing people were dead just because they don't call you up the very minute they said they would. Maybe the clock's fast. I don't know whether it's right. Maybe he's hardly late at all. Anything could have made him a little late. Maybe he had to stay at his office. Maybe he went home to call me up from there and somebody came in. He doesn't like to telephone me in front of people. Maybe he's worried just a little bit about keeping me waiting. He might even hope that I would call him up. I could do that. I could telephone him. I mustn't, I mustn't, I mustn't. Oh, God, please don't let me telephone him. Please keep me from doing that. I know, God, just as well as you do, that if he were worried about me, he'd telephone no matter where he was or how many people there were around him. Please make me know that. God, I don't ask you to make it easy for me. You can't do that for all that. You could make a world. Only let me know it, God. Don't let me go on hoping. Don't let me say comforting things to myself. Please don't let me hope, dear God. Please don't. I won't telephone him. I'll never telephone him again as long as I live. He'll rot in hell before I'll call him up. You don't have to give me strength, God. I have it myself. If he wanted me, he could get me. He knows where I am. He knows I'm waiting here. He's so sure of me, so sure. I wonder why they hate you as soon as they are sure of you. I should think it would be so sweet to be sure. It would be so easy to telephone him. Then I'd know. Maybe it wouldn't be a foolish thing to do. Maybe he wouldn't mind. Maybe he'd like it. Maybe he's been trying to get me. Sometimes people try and try to get you on the telephone and they say the number doesn't answer. I'm not just saying that to help myself. That really happens. You know that really happens, God. Oh, God, keep me away from that telephone. Keep me away. Let me still have just a little bit of pride. I think I'm going to need it, God. I think it will be all I have. Oh, what does pride matter when I can't stand it if I don't talk to him? Pride like that is such a silly, shabby little thing. The real pride, the big pride, is in having no pride. I'm not saying that just because I want to call him. I am not. That's true. I know that's true. I will be big. I will be beyond little prides. Please, God, keep me from telephoning him. Please, God. I don't see what pride has to do with it. This is such a little thing for me to be bringing in pride, for me to be making such a fuss about. I may have misunderstood him. Maybe he said for me to call him up at 5. Call me at 5, darling. He could have said that perfectly well. It's so possible that I didn't hear him right. Call me at 5, darling. I'm almost sure that's what he said. God, don't let me talk this way to myself. Make me know. Please make me know. I'll think about something else. I'll just sit quietly. If I could sit still. If I could sit still. Maybe I could read. Oh, all the books are about people who love each other truly and sweetly. What do they want to write about that for? Don't they know it isn't true? Don't they know it's a lie? It's a goddamn lie. What do they have to tell about that for when they know how it hurts? Damn them, damn them, damn them. I won't. I'll be quiet. This is nothing to get excited about. Look, suppose he were someone I didn't know very well. Suppose he were another girl. Then I'd just telephone and say, well, for goodness sake, what happened to you? That's what I'd do, and I'd never even think about it. Why can't I be casual and natural just because I love him? I can be. Honestly, I can be. I'll call him up and be so easy and pleasant. You see, if I won't, God. Oh, don't let me call him. Don't. God, are you really going to let him call me? Are you sure, God? Couldn't you please relent? Couldn't you? I don't even ask you to let him telephone me now, God. Only let him do it in a little while. I'll count 500 by fives. I'll do it so slowly and so fairly. If he hasn't telephoned then, I'll call him. I will. Oh, please, dear God, dear kind God, my blessed Father in heaven, let him call before then. Please, God, please. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35. And that was A Telephone Call by Dorothy Parker from 50 Best American Short Stories, edited by Martha Foley. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and bye for now.